So imagine stepping onto a really crowded subway train, right? And the absolute second you get inside, your coat gets completely caught in the sliding doors.
Oh, that is the worst feeling. Just instantly trapped.
Right. And it doesn't even matter if you want to get off at the very next stop. You are physically stuck inside that train car until the transit authority finally, decides to open those specific doors again.
You're just along for the ride at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And right now, in FDA trial rooms all across the country, researchers are realizing that this is exactly what LSD does to the human brain on like a literal molecular level.
Yeah, the mechanics of how these molecules physically lock themselves into our neurochemistry, it is completely rewriting what we thought we knew. I mean, we have this huge tendency to rely on, decades of folklore to explain these states of mind.
Oh, totally. The whole shag carpet mythology of it all.
Yeah, exactly. But the actual structural biology reveals a narrative that is far stranger. We are looking at two substances that are treated as completely different universes by the law, by the culture, yet they are essentially hijacking the exact same biological architecture.
And that structural reality, that's our mission for you today. We are looking past the cultural myths and the modern clinic marketing to find out what actually separates the iconic mushroom from the molecule.
Which is a lot more complex than just where they come from.
It really is. So we're using a single, incredibly comprehensive source for this deep dive. It's a June 2026 article from the OOTW Journal titled "Psilocybin versus LSD, the Neuroscience Compared." We are going to map out the physical receptors, the massive potency gaps, the clinical pathways, and what happens when you try to engineer a faster exit from the trip.
But before we pull apart the pharmacology here, let's just set the parameters for this exploration. We are strictly analyzing the neurobiology, the receptor affinities, the latest clinical trial data from the source text.
Right. This is a deep educational look at the science. It is not medical advice or, a guide to application.
Definitely not. Please keep that firmly in mind.
Okay, let's unpack this. To really understand the divergence between these two, we have to start at their shared foundation, because in the pharmacological literature, both of these are classified as classic psychedelics, right?
Yeah, that classic label is very specific. They earn that title because their signature effects rely heavily on one specific neural lock, which is the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor.
The 5-HT2A receptor, that's the one.
That receptor is the critical bottleneck for the entire profound experience. And the source material highlights a really elegant proof for this, actually.
Oh, right, the blocker drug.
Yeah, ketanserin. If you administer a compound called ketanserin to a subject, it acts as an antagonist. It essentially just parks itself in that 5-HT2A receptor and completely blocks it.
Like putting a broken key in the lock so nothing else can get in.
Exactly like that. And if you do that, the psychedelic effects of both compounds vanish entirely. You could take a massive dose of either, but if that specific receptor door is boarded up, the profound shift in consciousness simply does not happen.
That is wild. So the lock is absolutely identical, but the keys are manufactured in an entirely different ways. Like psilocybin is a naturally occurring tryptamine. It's built organically inside the cells of psilocybe mushrooms. But, and this is the fascinating detail, psilocybin itself is basically inactive.
Right, it's a prodrug, which is just a brilliant evolutionary quirk.
Wait, explain the prodrug mechanism for us, because I think that's super interesting.
So when you ingest psilocybin, your brain can't actually use it in that state. The molecule has this this bulky phosphate group attached to it,
Okay.
and that phosphate makes the compound highly stable while it just sits out in nature inside the mushroom. But for it to cross the blood-brain barrier and actually fit into that 5-HT2A lock we talked about, your digestive system has to do the heavy lifting.
So your body has to physically alter it.
Yeah, your body acts as a chemical refinery. It physically strips away that phosphate group through metabolism. And what you are left with after that is the active compound, which is psilocin.
Psilocin. Okay, I always use this analogy. It's essentially a biological meal kit. You receive the package, but you have to prep the ingredients before you can actually serve it to your nervous system.
That is a great way to look at it. You have to cook it, biologically speaking.
Right. But LSD is built on a totally different philosophy. Lysergic acid diethylamide is a semi-synthetic ergoline. It's built on a very rigid, multi-ringed ergot scaffold, originally synthesized back in 1938.
By Albert Hofmann.
You're right. And unlike the mushroom meal kit, LSD requires zero prep from your body. It comes ready to eat and is directly active the absolute second it hits your bloodstream.
And because of that rigid, complex ergoline structure, LSD is fundamentally less selective about where it parks in the brain. Psilocin is relatively targeted, but LSD is more like a shotgun blast.
A shotgun blast of chemistry.
Exactly. The text notes that alongside those primary serotonin receptors, LSD also heavily targets dopamine D2 receptors.
Which is huge.
Yeah, and it binds to alpha adrenergic receptors, which are tied to adrenaline and physical stimulation. It even binds to the TRKB receptor, which is the primary site for brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
Wait, BDNF, that's essentially the brain's mechanism for neuroplasticity and growth, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's like miracle growth for the brain. So LSD is hitting all of these extra biological targets all at once.
And all that extra activity helps explain the sheer brute force math of the molecule.
Yeah.
The OOTW Journal points out this staggering potency gap between the two. Like, we measure a standard dose of psilocybin in milligrams, typically 15 to 30 milligrams of the isolated compound.
Right, which is already a very small amount.
It is. But LSD is measured in micrograms, millionths of a gram. A standard dose is anywhere from 100 to 200 micrograms. That makes LSD roughly 100 to 200 times more potent by mass.
Think about the physical footprint of that for a second. You are talking about a microscopic speck of dust. It is literally one of the most potent psychoactive substances ever discovered.
It's crazy.
You can fit an intensely profound 12-hour experience onto a tiny square of paper that absorbs just a fraction of a drop of liquid.
Okay, I have to stop and challenge the phrasing there, though. Because when the literature says 200 times more potent, it sounds incredibly intimidating. Like, if I take a drug that is 200 times stronger by weight, the natural assumption is that it's going to melt my brain 200 times faster.
That is what everyone thinks, yeah.
Right. So is it fundamentally a more intense, overwhelming substance?
No, and it is a vital distinction to make. In pharmacology, potency and intensity are two entirely different metrics. Potency refers strictly to the physical weight required to activate the receptor.
Just the amount of dust.
Exactly. It's simply how much chemical dust you need to turn the key. Intensity, on the other hand, is the subjective ceiling of the effect, how high you actually go.
Okay, that makes sense.
And the University of Basel actually ran a definitive study to decouple these two concepts.
Oh, that's the double-blind crossover study, right? Where they took 28 volunteers and gave them both substances on separate days.
Yes. They wanted to see what happens when you adjust the dose to account for that massive weight discrepancy. So they found that 30 milligrams of psilocybin produces an intensity curve that roughly matches 150 micrograms of LSD.
So they equalized the subjective experience.
They did. And when you scale the doses to match in intensity, the peak altitude of the experience is completely comparable. You need radically less LSD to reach the summit, but the summit itself is the exact same height.
The altitude is the same. I love that. Oh. But the amount of time you are forced to spend on that mountain, that's where the real divergence happens.
Oh, massively.
Because a typical psilocybin session is a highly manageable 4 to 6 hours. You can essentially undergo the entire process between breakfast and late afternoon.
It's a day trip.
Literally. But LSD is an absolute marathon. We are looking at 8 to 12 hours. The Basel study logged the subjective effects of that 200 microgram dose lasting almost 12 full hours.
And for decades, the assumption was just that LSD took longer for your liver and kidneys to filter out of the bloodstream.
Just basic metabolism. But here's where it gets really interesting.
This is not just metabolism.
No. That circulatory clearance rate was the dominant theory until this major structural biology breakthrough in 2017.
Yeah, researchers were finally able to map the crystal structure of an LSD molecule physically bound to a serotonin receptor. In this specific case, it was the 5-HT2B receptor.
And what they saw is just mind-blowing.
It completely rewrote our understanding of the drug's duration. They observed that when the LSD molecule slides into the binding pocket, an extracellular loop of the receptor's own amino acids folds down over the top of the molecule.
It forms a literal biological lid.
A lid, yes. Your own brain chemistry physically traps the foreign molecule inside the receptor.
Which brings us right back to the subway door analogy from the intro. You are physically caught in the mechanism.
And the kinetics of this are just fascinating. Because the receptor folds over the drug, LSD dissociates, meaning it unbinds, and leaves the lock at an incredibly slow, agonizing pace.
So it's just stuck there, pushing the button.
Exactly. The chemical signal continues to fire relentlessly, hour after hour, long after the vast majority of the actual drug has been metabolized and cleared from your blood plasma.
Wow.
The key is stuck in the lock because the doorknob folded over it.
That is incredible. And this biological quirk, it creates an enormous logistical bottleneck for modern clinical psychiatry.
It's a huge hurdle.
Right. Because if you are running a clinic attempting to roll out this treatment for depression, scheduling is everything. Psilocybin's five-hour window fits neatly into a standard 9-to-5 workday.
You can actually schedule it.
Exactly. A single therapist can guide the patient, let the effects subside, and the patient goes home for dinner.
But LSD's 12-hour window shatters that whole clinical model. You cannot ask a single clinical therapist to sit for 12 straight hours while maintaining intense psychological focus.
No, that's dangerous for everyone.
Right. You are suddenly talking about shift work, staggered staffing, and drastically higher overhead costs for just a single session. From a purely operational standpoint, psilocybin is simply more compatible with modern medical infrastructure.
Okay, let's pivot from the infrastructure to the actual lived experience of the patient. Because if you read the folklore, or really listen to anyone embedded in this culture, they insist these two drugs produce wildly different subjective flavors.
The cultural consensus is very strong on this.
Right. The OTW Journal summarizes it perfectly. LSD is considered bright, electric, highly cerebral, and outward-facing. Psilocybin is described as warm, earthy, deeply emotional, and inward-facing.
The narrative is incredibly pervasive. People will passionately defend the idea that a synthesized ergoline feels cold and clinical, while a fungal tryptamine feels grounded and ancient.
But wait, earlier we established that LSD hits a scattershot of different receptors, right? It binds to alpha-adrenergic receptors, triggering physical stimulation. It hits dopamine receptors.
Yes, it has a broader receptor profile.
So shouldn't that biological reality mean that LSD does fundamentally feel different? Shouldn't all that extra receptor activity make it actually feel more electric? Are the psychonauts right?
That is the logical assumption, and honestly, it's why the Basel crossover study is so disruptive to the established lore.
Because they tested exactly this.
Exactly. The researchers went in knowing about those different receptor profiles. Yet when they took those 28 subjects, blinded them to what they were taking, and matched the doses for intensity, the qualitative differences just vanished.
Wait, really? The subjects couldn't tell the difference?
Statistically, no. The overall quality, the emotional depth, the character of the experiences, they were virtually indistinguishable.
That is crazy. So the electric versus earthy vibe is just made up.
The researchers concluded that this divide is almost entirely a product of expectation, set, and setting. If you know you are consuming a fungus that grew out of the soil, your brain primes itself for an earthy, mystical journey.
Right, you bring the earthiness to the trip.
Yes. And if you know you are taking a rigid chemical synthesized in a mid-century Swiss laboratory, you anticipate a sharp, cerebral, electric trip.
So your brain acts as the ultimate set designer. It builds the narrative based on the origin story of the drug, not necessarily the slight variations in receptor affinity.
Precisely. Now, the text does point out a very minor physiological split. Psilocybin tends to raise blood pressure slightly more, while LSD leans toward elevating the heart rate.
Okay, so minor physical differences.
Right. But mentally, they both drive the brain toward the exact same neurological destination, which is the entropic brain state.
And the entropic brain state is, like, the holy grail for psychiatric research right now.
It really is.
Yeah.
To understand why it's so valuable, you have to think about the default mode network in your brain. Yeah, that network acts as the rigid CEO of your mind. It maintains your ego, your sense of past and future, and crucially, your daily anxieties.
So when you are ruminating on a mistake you made like 3 years ago or obsessing over a weird social interaction,
that is your default mode network running in a highly rigid, hyperconnected loop. It's stuck.
And both of these compounds essentially fire the CEO for a few hours. They drop the integrity of that network, totally scrambling those rigid loops.
And the subjective feeling of that biological process is what people describe as ego dissolution.
Right, losing your sense of self.
Exactly. Your brain becomes highly disorganized or entropic, which sounds terrifying, but it's actually the exact mechanism that allows the mind to break free from those deeply ingrained ruts of depression and anxiety.
It provides a profound psychological reset.
Yes. The neural pathways that govern your rumination are temporarily suspended, allowing the brain to communicate across regions that normally never talk to each other.
And because both compounds trigger this exact same therapeutic state, modern medicine is aggressively pursuing both of them. However, and this is fascinating, they are currently racing down completely distinct clinical pathways.
Very distinct, yeah.
Like, psilocybin has firmly planted its flag in the realm of depression. The article details the progress of Compass Pathways, which has pushed a synthetic formulation of psilocybin COMP360 through consecutive phase 3 trials targeting treatment-resistant depression.
Right. They are banking on that entropic reset to break the heavy, rigid loops of depressive rumination.
But LSD, conversely, is being anchored to anxiety. MindMed is running massive phase 3 trials using a pharmaceutical form of LSD-MM120 to target generalized anxiety disorder. And those are expected to read out in late 2026.
And it's worth noting that both compounds have secured FDA breakthrough therapy status.
Meaning the federal government actually recognizes they offer a substantial improvement over existing therapies.
Yes, which is a massive paradigm shift.
It really is. Which brings up the unavoidable conversation about safety, because pushing these powerful compounds into the mainstream medical system requires an intense look at their risk profiles.
Absolutely.
Now, by the standards of traditional pharmaceuticals, both are remarkably physically gentle. They don't cause physical dependence or addiction. There is no established lethal overdose limit anywhere near standard recreational or clinical levels.
Right. The primary risks remain heavily psychological.
Because of that vulnerability.
Yes. The intense vulnerability of the entropic brain state means that difficult psychological experiences can and do happen. And here, the duration factor rears its head again.
Oh, because a bad trip lasts longer.
Exactly. A challenging, terrifying psychological loop on psilocybin might last 3 hours. On LSD, a patient might be locked into that state for 8 hours.
That sounds exhausting.
It is. Additionally, the epidemiological surveys in the text consistently report higher incidences of HPPD, hallucinogen persisting perception disorder, following LSD use compared to psilocybin.
HPPD, right. That's the lingering visual static or disturbances some people get.
Yes, it's more common with LSD.
Okay, so what does this all mean when we get to the heart question? Because the source dives into a very specific physiological concern revolving around that 5-HT2B receptor we talked about earlier, the one with the lid.
The heart question is a critical piece of pharmacology to monitor right now.
Yeah. The text explicitly links this receptor to the fenfen diet drug scandal from the 1990s. And for context for you listening, fenfen was pulled from the market because it was overstimulating that specific receptor, causing fibroblasts to overproduce tissue and physically damage people's heart valves.
Right, which is obviously very serious. And both LSD and psilocybin act as agonists at that exact same 5-HT2B receptor.
So they push the same danger button?
They do. However, the context of administration completely changes the risk profile.
How so?
The heart valve damage associated with fenfen occurred because patients were taking the drug daily. They were providing chronic, unrelenting activation of that receptor. A clinical psychedelic session, on the other hand, is an acute, isolated event. You do it once or perhaps a few times a year.
So the concern isn't the macrodose session in a clinic. The theoretical risk applies directly to the modern trend of microdosing, doesn't it?
Exactly. Taking small, sub-perceptual amounts of these drugs multiple times a week is a productivity hack.
Right.
The chronic activation involved in a weekly microdosing regimen mimics the administration pattern of fenfen far more closely.
And interestingly, the source points out a severe irony here for those who champion natural substances over lab-made chemicals.
Oh, the binding affinity data.
Yes. Psilocin, the active compound in the natural mushroom, actually binds to this potentially problematic heart receptor with significantly higher affinity than the synthetic LSD does.
It's true. The natural option is technically hitting the danger button harder.
Which totally flips the script on natural is always safer. Though the article is very careful to state that to date, there has never been a documented real-world case of valvular heart disease linked to the use of classic psychedelics.
Right. It remains a theoretical biological gap. It's a caution flag for the microdosing community rather than a proven clinical harm at this point.
But to cement just how biologically similar these two compounds really are inside the human nervous system, we only need to look at how the brain defends itself against them, because the mechanism of cross-tolerance is the ultimate proof of their shared pathway.
It really is the smoking gun.
Right. Because when you take a significant dose of psilocybin, your brain recognizes the massive flood of stimulation at the 5-HT2A receptor site. And to protect itself from being constantly overwhelmed, the brain physically retracts those receptors. It downregulates them.
And within days, you build a massive physical tolerance.
But the fascinating part is that this tolerance is entirely blind to the specific drug.
Exactly. If you build a tolerance to psilocybin on a Tuesday and attempt to take LSD on a Thursday, the LSD will have a drastically blunted effect.
The brain has pulled back the locks. It does not care which key you're trying to use.
The physiological response proves they are utilizing the exact same neural doorway.
So if the brain fundamentally cannot tell the difference between these two compounds once tolerance hits, why has the legal system treated them so drastically different?
That is the million-dollar question.
Because looking at the map in 2026, the legislative divergence is massive. I mean, federally, they are both trapped in Schedule 1, meaning the DEA officially considers them to have high abuse potential and no accepted medical use, despite the FDA granting them breakthrough therapy status.
The federal contradiction is glaring, but the state level is where the true legal fracture is occurring.
Right. Psilocybin has generated incredible legislative momentum. You have established licensed service programs operating in Oregon and Colorado. Colorado even passed Prop 122, decriminalizing personal cultivation and use. New Mexico and other states are bringing their own medical frameworks online.
Psilocybin is rapidly integrating into a regulated above-ground society.
And LSD has absolutely none of that.
Zero.
There is no state-level momentum for licensed LSD facilitators. It remains strictly locked down in the federal trial system. It really highlights how deeply the cultural narrative influences our laws.
It does. The mushroom is perceived as a natural ancient medicine from the earth, so voters and legislatures are willing to tolerate it.
Right.
But LSD is perceived as a volatile lab chemical from the 1960s counterculture, so it remains politically radioactive. Regardless of the fact that the neuroscience proves they induce the exact same therapeutic state.
It is a profound example of biology and sociology just totally clashing. We have two dramatically different molecular structures separated by massive gaps in potency and duration, ultimately funneling human consciousness into the exact same entropic state of healing.
Which is pretty beautiful when you think about it.
It really is. Which leaves us with a truly compelling question about where this all goes next. Because the OOTW Journal dropped a fascinating detail about that 2017 receptor discovery.
The one with the lid?
Yeah. Researchers didn't just map the biological lid that traps LSD, they actively manipulated it. The text notes that when scientists engineered the receptor's lid to be more mobile, to physically open up faster, it dramatically sped up LSD's exit from the brain and altered its downstream signaling.
They sped up the trip.
Exactly. So if scientists can successfully tweak how long that receptor's lid stays shut, what does the future of psychedelic medicine actually look like? We might not be strictly limited to the biology of a 5-hour mushroom or the chemistry of a 12-hour molecule.
We could customize it.
Right. What happens when the next massive breakthrough isn't discovering a new drug entirely, but engineering a perfectly tailored 45-minute profound reset, a completely customized molecular key designed to fit perfectly into a patient's lunch break?
A lunch break therapy session. That changes the entire medical landscape.
The debate has moved far beyond which drug is better. We are rapidly approaching a reality where the lock and the key can be entirely customized. So thank you for joining us on this deep dive. And keep questioning the narratives you think you know.